Welcome to the podcast Tourism from Zero, where we bring you stories about interesting tourism stakeholders in your country. My name is Rudy Medved, and I am accompanied by guests who share their exciting tourism experiences of how they move tourism from zero to hero. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another Tourism from Zero podcast episode. Of course, not a normal one. It's another Earth special episode. And we have another special guest, another Earth member, Dr. Gunnar Johannesson. And of course, Miha Bratec, which you already know from the last episode. So for the beginning, I will ask Dr. Gunnar to introduce himself a little bit.
Yes. Hello, Rudy and Miha, and thank you for the invitation. As you said, my name is Gunnar Thor Johannesson. I work as a professor at the Department of Geography and Tourism at the University of Iceland, Reykjavik. And I have been here for the last 8 years or so, studying tourism, although my background is anthropology, and I sort of got involved with tourism research when I was doing my PhD back in the days, and haven't left that field at all since then, you could say. Well, in terms of research, then I've been studying various things, but you could say, broadly speaking, my focus has been on placemaking and mobility. That has involved studies of innovation and entrepreneurship, but also policy. And actually recently issues like tourism employment and so on. So, and I do my teaching here also at the University of Iceland, where I teach innovation in tourism, theories in tourism, policy and planning, and so that's sort of more of the same, you could say. So that's me in brief.
Great, thank you.
Thanks. Yeah, I wanted to ask, of course, while preparing for this podcast, I had a look at your Google Scholar profile, and what I saw from there is that you are mainly, or not mainly, but very often dealing with actor network theory in tourism research. And I mean, I am not really proficient in this field. I generally have an idea what it is. But if we are to translate, let's say, our research as researchers to tourism entrepreneurs, how would you kind of explain the actor network theory? How can it kind of depict tourism entrepreneurships and the tourism challenges?
That's a good question. Yeah, that's true. I actually I did my PhD in Roskilde University, finished in 2007, and then I was working with actor network theory. And at that time, it was a relatively new approach. We were not that many that were using that approach in tourism research. And my study was actually on, I basically followed a project, innovative development project in cultural tourism that was being carried out in Iceland and a few other countries, actually focusing on the Viking heritage. And there I used it in order to describe the networking that was sort of underlying the enactment of that project. Basically, what I was interested in was to see how an idea of a project, as this was, how it was carried out and realized. And there you could use actor network theory to sort of assist you and tune into the networking, the relations, the connections necessary to carry out or get this particular project done in a particular situation or context. And since then, I have worked a lot with A&T together with my colleagues, Karina Ren and René van der Dijm, as well as others. And all of the three of us, we did our PhDs on actor network theory and tourism. And but we also use it in different different ways in a way. You could say there are different things that people take out of it. And I think that's noticeable in our work. But like in the stuff that we have done jointly together, I think this is sort of the main issues. That is this focus on relationality of things. That, for instance, the entrepreneur is not a single person or a kind of a singular unit, but always a part of a wider network of relations. And then you also have this focus on the materiality of things. And that's often quite interesting to sort of, show that and make that visible, not at least in the case of tourism, that is full of materials and technologies that are necessary to carry out tourism, if you like. So I don't know if I answered the question, but at least, hopefully some of it.
Yeah, I mean, because, you know, the entrepreneurs often talk in words of entrepreneurial ecosystems and the regional entrepreneurial ecosystems and so on. So how would you say that actor network is different from that, like, general business, more business-oriented terminology? Which are the insights that you gain through it?
Yes. Well, the difference is, perhaps on this relationality of things and when it comes to performance and materiality. It's the focus of actor network theory is often on the ordering, how a particular order is created and accomplished. And there, I think A&T sort of gives you particular tools to draw up a picture of a network that is in place. But it's also critical about the shape of those networks. And this is now I'm maybe opening up towards a long discussion of A&T, but to cut it short, then A&T was often criticized for being quite functionalistic in a way, basically stating that everything was a network. What has sometimes been termed as post-A&T, and I think as most people are using A&T today, the focus is not so much on the network organization as such, but more on the relationality that can take different forms. So it opens up for, thinking through entrepreneurship in quite different ways.
Okay, so that we don't really like go too much into actor network and theorizing. If you connect and apply actor network theory onto innovation and then into the context of like Iceland, it's a very specific tourist destination. It's not, let's say, the mainstream European Mediterranean sun and beach destination, no? How would you say, how has this, like your specific location impacted your research and your views towards innovation in tourism?
Yes, if I stick still a little bit to actor network theory and then maybe just tell you a little bit how I sort of approached it. A few years ago, I did a research on tourism policymaking in Iceland. And actually that's a really important sort of field to understand how tourism has developed and as a sector on the island. And there, one of the things that sort of came to light and sort of A&T assisted me in sort of highlighting was the role of other unlikely actors, you could say, in the story. So it came apparent that tourism was not at all only about tourism as we often think about it as airlines and travel bureaus and tourists. But in the case of Iceland, it was also about cod, the fish cod.
The fish cod, yeah.
Yeah, the cod. And the disappearance of the cod from the ocean around the island in the early 1990s. It was also about volcano eruptions and how a particular volcano eruption in 2010 actually affected air traffic in Europe and actually put Iceland on the map, for better or worse, for a while. So you could say that as an approach, it sort of opens up many of those maybe commonsensical orders that we often have when we are approaching a subject like tourism, and maybe blurs the boundaries of tourism and showing us that tourism is very, well, complex, but also very messy entity, if you like. So I think that's maybe one way that I have used this particular approach to also to understand the dynamics of tourism development on the island.
So you could somehow say that tourism network in tourism has no boundaries then?
Well, it's in theory, it has no boundaries, but and that's sort of one of those, well, rather contested claims of A&T, but of course, in practice, the boundaries are made and they are constructed and composed in often quite complex network. So, and that's actually it's a quite interesting history of policy making. And I don't know if we have time to go through it here, maybe very briefly, just to sort of also clarify and give you an example of how this might work. But as I said, in the early 1990s, the cod, which is the most important export product of Iceland, and still is actually, disappeared almost from the waters here around the island. And so there was a crisis, economic crisis. And Iceland has always relied very much on the fisheries as the backbone of the economy. At that time, there was actually the head of the Iceland Tourist Board that actually pointed at the fact that one ton of cod equaled one tourist in foreign currency income. So that, by that sort of this connection was made. So tourism was translated into something that people understood. And when I say people understood, and I mean especially the politicians and the authorities. Mm. So that was a kind of a breaking point for actually getting tourism recognition in the system. And from there on, from 1995, 1996, we have actually a functional tourism policy. We can discuss if it was has always been carried out or not. Some people would say that many things actually have not been carried successfully out through the years, but at least it was there and it was stated there, and it got a place, it got a seat at the table where the economy of the nation was discussed. So that was something that I think people would probably not have seen if we would have approached tourism from sort of more traditional social constructionist approach.
Mm-hmm. But another, let's say, like crisis before we come to the current crisis, no? Mm-hmm. I mean, tell me if I'm wrong, but my idea is somehow that Iceland became a bit more mainstream. I mean, still not a mainstream destination, but it became a bit more attractive at the time when country was really like facing its like biggest economic demons, when country was going bankrupt and so on, simply because of that, because it became a bit more affordable compared to the rest of mm-hmm. continental Europe. And this was drawing, I mean, the landscape is unique, has been unique, but it was just like usually a tad too expensive for an average European budget to be able to afford a trip there. And I think with this situation, your economic downturn, you kind of managed to popularize it as a destination. At least this is how I see it from my European perspective. And now I would like to hear your opinion.
Yeah, I think you're right in many aspects. I mean, what happened in 2008 was that Iceland literally got bankrupt and was one of the first victims of the global financial crunch or crisis. And this meant that all of a sudden it became, as you said, a very, very cheap and affordable destination, still quite exotic one. And that also matters because, I mean, of course, the financial crisis also affected some of the main markets that for Iceland are the, especially the UK and the US. And so it is other things that also, you know, played into this. For instance, as I said, this volcano eruption, Eyjafjallajökull eruption in 2010. And then an increasing interest in the north in general, something that we could really perceive here, and the Arctic, everything Arctic is sort of in. And we could see, for instance, a huge increasing, well, huge increase in winter tourism. And, but of course, yeah, and at the same time also, the air connectivity of the island was improved. So lots of airlines actually began to service Icelandic tourism. So, and that of course is the prerequisite of tourism to get the people here. And at the same time, the domestic airlines, we had two domestic airlines offering quite affordable and cheap tickets actually. So, so the connectivity was of course a key to it as well. Then, I mean, we had an exponential growth of tourism arrivals from 2010 to 2018 or so, when it began to slow down and then eventually decrease. And so it, the tourist arrivals, the number began to decrease before COVID. And it's difficult to say if the destination had sort of reached a status of saturation. There were other issues. And then I think, of course, it mattered sort of the price and how much it costed to come here. But so that, but that's I think it's a fairly good description that you gave.
Okay, so basically the first crisis, let's say the first crisis in our eyes of the recent crisis, is no kind of helped Iceland, and what is happening now? I mean, you just exposed reliance to cheap connections, airline connections, and we know this year somehow stopped the air traffic.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. And how was the reaction in Iceland? What is the state at the moment? What is life? I think you're a bit removed from Europe. I guess your restrictions are not that severe at the moment as they are where we live. But how did the whole destination cope and what's going on at the moment?
Yeah, that's true. I think our situation is more lax here than in most parts of Europe. Of course, what happened was that tourism practically halted and overnight. And, you know, the effects were, of course, devastating. And tourism provided in 2019 more than 8% of the GDP. So it was a huge, it's a huge pillar. And maybe that's one of the weaknesses in the sort of the economic setup of Iceland as it was, how dependent Iceland was on this single industry or sector. Currently, I mean, there's not much happening. The country is not closed, but it's difficult to travel, and as we all know. So tourism is just on hold, you could say. This spring and summer, there was a surge in domestic tourism. We had a kind of a pause in COVID infections at that time. So mm-hmm. people actually could travel domestically and did that. So actually, in some of the peripheral areas in Iceland, where people actually saw an increase in tourism, while the capital area and the south coast, which is sort of the the main tourism parts of the country, they have suffered a lot, and especially the capital. So the government is supporting the companies and sectors as it can, but it's obvious that and of course many companies will not survive this, and it still remains to be seen actually where we will be at this spring. And as you can hear, it's a lot of uncertainty, and we really do not know how things will be. So it's difficult to say, to say the least.
True. Yeah. Have you, in all this uncertainty, see something positive or something that was really innovative, how the sector coped?
Yes, I have to say that. And my department, we are part of the Icelandic Tourism Cluster.
Yeah.
It's a cluster of tourism companies and other institutes and relating to tourism. And for instance, both the cluster and also the Icelandic Tourist Industry Association, they have been advocating and sort of promoting the rethinking of tourism and urging companies and entrepreneurs to use the time to rethink their strategies, and maybe, for instance, look into educational offers, training of staff, and so on and so forth. So work on some internal issues that nobody had time to work on when everything was on as it was.
Yeah, yeah, and when you were busy accepting tourists.
Exactly. Yes, exactly. So, of course, you can be ironical about that. And you have to, of course, have some income to be able to pay your stuff and so on. But at least the discussion has started and the dialogue has started with a focus on sustainable and responsible tourism in the wake of COVID. And who knows how it will go, but at least I think many entrepreneurs and many companies are thinking along those terms that maybe we will not go back to normal as it used to be, but to some new normal, which is more based on maybe slower growth and with a more focus on sustainable development. So as I said, it remains to be seen if that will turn out like that, but at least I'm hopeful, and I'm really actually happy to see that, well, actually how many are dealing with this crisis in that positive sense. So that's at least a good sign.
So you'd say, let's say that the basis for innovation are there because there's time for reflection and start to think about optimizations.
Yeah, the basis is there, and it has also given the whole sector, I think, a kick and to reevaluate how and ask themselves and reflect on what kind of tourism would we like to have here on the island. Should we try to build it up in different ways than before, so we actually do not put all our eggs in the same basket, for instance. And so how to do that? How can we create a more robust sector for the future? And for a destination like Iceland, that's I think that the answer does not lie in actually going back to mass tourism development that definitely was underway, at least partly here in Iceland. Mm-hmm. So rather to focus on something else.
Okay, so we've covered, let's say, the tourism product and Iceland. More generally, I think Rudy has a question.
Yeah, as far as the recovery goes, how do you personally view tourism should restart, let's say, after the pandemic passes away? So after tourism, let's say, goes back to normal, the flights go back to normal, and how do you think tourism should look like?
Well, it's a big question. But obviously, I mean, it's you can always hope for the best, and I am aware that if we just sort of being realistic, then there's obviously a very strong pressure on going back to what it used to be, and on growth, and quick growth. I think we will see that situation, and then it depends on sort of the tourism stakeholders, the government, the municipalities, of course, the sector itself, the private companies, and also us, you know, the academics and researchers, to sort of take this discussion and take this argument. I mean, how would we like to move on? And I think that discussion has to focus on values. I mean, and how we actually value, like, growth. What does growth mean? How does it matter? And in what ways can we think about it in different ways? What is well-being for communities in Iceland? And I'm not necessarily sure that we have one answer or one solution for all. I actually doubt that. But I think that we need to actually look into how tourism is affecting places in different ways. And we need to be able to take decisions focusing on, like, the values of sustainability, taking care of our our resources, both when it comes to nature, but also culture and society. And I think for the long term, I think that must be sort of the goal for tourism development, to being a positive force rather than a negative one, and being a positive force to build up robust communities, build up well-being of people, both residents but also tourists. And I think that's must be the goal. But if we are just going to, you know, get back to business as usual, then, I mean, we know that we cannot actually do it if we think a few decades ahead. I mean, we know that we are actually spending the Earth's resources way too fast. And so there's no future in that. We need to change the future. And I think actually that tourism can be a positive force in that regard.
Mm-hmm. So what would you say, like, because obviously you know best Iceland in terms of destinations, mm-hmm. what would be the, let's say, the three most important changes for Iceland, or let's say also innovations, if you want, we can call it like that, that you need to repair, let's say the repairs, if we are talking like car that we take to the service shop and it needs to be repaired. What are the most necessary things?
Wow. So easy question. I think that, well, first of all, we need to, as I said, we need to take this argument and we need to not shy away from it and actually deal with these with this challenge. I mean, for me, I do not perceive COVID-19 as an isolated crisis. It is a crisis of the Anthropocene, for as I see it. It is a crisis of the way that we have been living our lives. And we need to take it seriously as such. So I think that's sort of the most important thing to change, is to sort of change the mentality when it comes to thinking about growth and economic development. I mean, as somebody said, we do not live in economies, we live in communities and societies, and we need to sort of stick to that and start from there. Then when it comes to tourism as well, so I think like in Iceland, as in many other destinations, we have actually currently quite nice policies, if you like. We have some ideas and some scenarios of sustainable tourism development for the future that actually speak into this change and sort of slower growth and so on. But sometimes the decisions being made do not actually fit that those ideas. So we need to sort of take better care of that, especially because being an island with almost only one entry gate into the country, mm-hmm. which is the international airport, it is quite easy to actually control and the sort of the accessibility of Iceland as a destination. And we need to sort of third and related, when it comes to resource management issues, planning and resource management of the main attractions, which are when we're talking about Iceland, it is the nature, and we need to take care of that. And then again, I think it's really important not to sort of seek for a one size fits all solutions to our problems, but rather look into what makes sense in particular instances, in particular cases. So as you know, I mean, tourism studies have sometimes been criticized for being all about case studies and not general theories. But in a way, that's a little bit like society works. We learn from cases, and the situation is different between locations. So we need to take that into account. So for instance, for particular routes or destinations in, for instance, the highlands of Iceland, we might need to have very strict management. And that's something that we might actually not need in some other places. And so I think, and this is especially, I think, acute when it comes to sort of rebuilding or restarting of tourism after COVID, then we need to actually work on this connection between the policy papers and the ideas of management and planning, and then how we're actually doing it in practice, the implementation bit. That's a big, big challenge, I think, for a destination like Iceland.
Yep.
I don't know if that made any sense, but
No, it did, definitely. Yeah. No, and I wanted to like make then like a link further that how do you see like all this like overflow of COVID-related research now in tourism, no?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, is COVID now just a common denominator that everyone pushes in the ideas he had even before? Or do you see it's really like some novel research stream?
Well, I think it's both. I think it's what we are witnessing, as you say, it's a kind of an overflow, and I think that's understandable because it is a crisis and something that nobody has sort of experienced before, and so people are sort of trying to get a grip on the situation, so I think that's very understandable. But of course, as an academic or as a researcher, you would like to see the novelty and make sure that your study is actually contributing to things in new ways. And I think that's, I mean, it is challenging because there's still so many things that we actually do not know. So the uncertainty is still so high that I think that you were sort of hinting at that many of those publications are actually repeating what we already know and do not maybe add very much. But having said that, I would still say that it's important to tackle it and actually integrate the COVID event, if I can say so, into tourism studies sort of mainstream discussion. And then it comes down to us as reviewers and editors of journals and books to take care that, well, at least some of this is actually contributing to things in new ways, isn't it?
I mean, certainly we'll have a much larger volume of crisis management, no literature now.
Definitely.
It's through all this COVID, if not something else. Because like each time you give students an assignment to write about crises in tourism, it's about Ebola, it's about SARS, it's about very distant realities, no? Or some Balkan wars, for example, from the area where we're coming from. And now we'll have a common denominator in terms of crisis in tourism. Now the whole world will have it, so.
Yes.
Yeah, definitely there will be progress.
And then progress. And I think also that it will add, I mean, it will also shape the sector in a way. And because as many have been pointing out, that most likely security, health issues, domestic tourism are sort of issues that are sort of coming to the agenda. And maybe issues that haven't got the attention that they maybe should have got before. So definitely there are good things coming out of this.
Yep. Yeah. From this perspective, certainly. I mean, it's both, you know, it's like in sort of opportunism to sell on old ideas in the new, let's say, context, as you said, in the new event, but also, yeah, we will have, we'll have new knowledge ultimately.
Yeah.
And new phenomenon to relate to and see pre and post comparisons and so on and see if the theories can be supported before the event, after the event, and so on. It's true. Like a benchmark, let's call it a benchmark, no, perhaps.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes,
totally. Yeah. Yeah. And now we've covered the research, no? And if we move a bit into the like tourism education, it's also like, it's also a big shift. I mean, we've been lecturing from home since last March, mainly. We went back to the classroom for 2 weeks in between at the beginning of the new academic year, then we were sent home again. But how do you see like the future of tourism education? I mean, the tourism industry is not going to be the most popular industry at the moment, no, due to the crisis and to the shrinkage it will kind of happen in the immediate months to follow. Do you think it's also like an opportunity for us to kind of reflect and see what we are giving the students and what the value of tourism education in such situation is?
Yes, I think it's definitely an opportunity, and I think it's necessary for us to rethink our curriculum and actually critically evaluate actually what is it that we are contributing with in order to rebuild our communities and actually build up a more robust and more sustainable sector. And it is not certain that it's the same things that we've been doing for the last years. And I think actually that we need to, how to put it? I think it's in a way, at least the crisis is sort of undermining the mantra of economic growth. And sort of urging people to really to reevaluate and rethink their sort of position in the world vis-a-vis the Earth's resources and how we actually are making use of them in a sustainable way. And we need to actually think about how we educate our students and sort of equip them to change the world. I think that sort of should be our task. And to assist our students to venture into work life and actually change things and be able to do that, to rethink and redo tourism. And I don't have the answer how to actually, what to add, what to what to drop from the curriculum, but I think we are in a dire need to focus on actually values and valuing and critically reflect on, okay, what is it that matters when it comes to, for instance, building up tourism in a country like Iceland or in the Arctic or in Slovenia or whatever. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of the task at hand. And it might well mean that we do not see that the student numbers rise, you know, again, not well, short term, but and that might actually mean that our futures might be rather bleak in a way. Mm-hmm. But I think it's also an interesting, and I'm just thinking a lot, but I would be curious to hear your opinion about it. But I think that in a way, one step ahead would be for us tourism scholars to work even more with other disciplines when it comes to studying tourism development, tourism entrepreneurship and innovation. And so try to get out of our boxes and collaborate with others.
I mean, yeah, definitely. That's also like one of the missions of ERT, no? That we kind of join people of different profiles who kind of collaborate and also like involve heavily with entrepreneurs and with the business reality. Because very often like academic cooperation with the businesses that we send them like a survey to fill out, no? And that's where it stops. It doesn't come to the point of discussion, to the exchange of ideas, to try to translate the two languages, no, and see how one can contribute to another.
And I think that's something that is changing now. I mean, at least, as you mentioned in the beginning, that we've been doing online teaching for almost a year now, and so it's a, and I think it has been a very healthy change for many, and sort of. Got teachers to realize that they can use their classroom time in different ways. And I'm not talking about necessarily turning everything into distance learning, but maybe try new teaching methods and that allow actually more active engagement of mm-hmm. students and also practitioners, entrepreneurs and so on. And my experience is actually that it has been easier in many ways to both include international guests in my teaching.
Yeah.
And also with having short visits from people in the industry. And that allows students to sort of, you know, gets them into, how do you say it? It's sort of get them better involved into the discussions that are happening on the ground.
Yeah, and give them additional perspectives, no? Of course, a general manager of a hotel will not come to your class if he needs to travel 1 hour, then he's lecturing with you for 1 hour, then you take him for a drink or a lunch or whatever, and then he needs to drive back. But plugging in into Zoom for like half an hour session, questions and answers and short presentation is not a problem majorly. Yeah. Everyone can squeeze this time now into a working day.
Yes, true. Yeah.
Additional. Yeah. So, okay, Rudy.
Yeah, that's true. I'm talking about right now from a student perspective, of course. And it was very positive. We had a lot of guests, more than usual, of course, in our classes, the faculty. And I see this very positive, and especially, like you said, because of the international guests. And like we are talking right now, I mean, that's very positive for me, for you, for everyone. And we're doing this like very easy. It's very simple to meet on Zoom. And I can hear your perspective from Iceland. And I mean, that's amazing for every student, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's it works very well. So, and I will probably post this podcast on my teaching.
Cool. We'll be happy. We can then list in our reference. We were guest lecturing in the University of Iceland. Yeah. You know.
It's good on the CV.
Yeah, it's good on the CV. Exactly. About overselling yourself. No. the new norms. Now we've covered quite diverse area of topics, and now I would like to go a bit more into the personal ground with you, Gunnar, because now we know what you do, what you research, what you teach, but we don't know anything about you as a person and as a tourist. So how would you describe yourself in this way?
How would I describe myself as a person?
Yeah, and as a traveling person, let's say traveling like person. This. Okay,
yeah. Yeah, that's good. I really haven't given it that much of a thought, but I mean, I think my kids would say that I'm sort of a 20th century person. So I am rather old fashioned when it comes to. comes to traveling, I think, but I'm laid back, my favorite moments are when I'm just sitting at a nice cafe and watching what is happening on the street, and I also when I'm traveling, I'm just wondering just right now what I'm doing, and I think I do sort of different things, you know. Of course, when you are a tourism scholar, you often have sort of the academic glasses on you. But I sometimes done some experiments, and I found that actually I really like many of those things that are very commonly described as mass tourism, and I'm rather ashamed to say that, but it's. I like so many hotels and lie on a beach and enjoy the sun, but for a while. But then, of course, I also like other things, and like being out in nature and doing hikes and so on. So it all depends on whom I'm with and what I'm doing and where I'm coming from. As with many people, and I think that's sort of a little bit in line with sort of my. My approach often that I'm quite critical on sort of tourism or tourist typologies and classifications, because when it comes to it, we are all many things, and we like different things. And I like, the same day I can be going to a museum and wondering about the authenticity of this or that painting, or and then I'm going and enjoy. Some kind of amusement park, and both is fun. And I think that's the key to me, for me, to enjoy myself with my friends and family.
So, like you said, you don't want to go into the typology. You think you can be multiple types of travelers, no, even on one trip. But I will correct you that you said that you are very 20th century. I don't think so, because sitting in the cafe and observing is actually the new tourist. According to Poon's classification, it's not just going from one site to another and collect, the main site. So you are not that old fashioned.
No, that's in that sense. Yeah, but I think when it comes to making use of social media and Instagram and so on, then I'm not there yet. So, but maybe I'll get there. And, That's why my kids are making fun of me.
That's Rudy's métier. That's what we leave to the Rudy's generation.
Yes, maybe. Yeah. Yeah.
The live transmission of holiday. This is we are too old for that, Gunnar.
Yeah, yes.
When we're on holiday, we want to enjoy, not to be bothered how we come across on social media.
Yeah. I'm not good at taking selfies, at least. So.
Yeah. All right. I would say Rudy will have final question for you. But before that, I will just ask you, since we're doing this series of ERT member, let's say, podcasts now for this year, when we will all still live quite remote from our living rooms and libraries and so on. Who would you nominate that we invite to be our next guest?
That's a good question. Well, the first name that pops to my mind is my my very good colleague, Karina Ren, who is also a member of the ERT Association. And she's an associate professor at Aalborg University in Denmark. And I think I will nominate her.
Yeah, I agree with you, because I have also like personal history, and she was the first lecturer that I faced when I went into the tourism. So that's a good bet. And Florian also mentioned her, so I think our next guest will be Karina. So we will travel a bit more south from Iceland back towards the main part of Europe, ask what she's doing in Copenhagen/Aalborg. Good. Okay, Rudy.
Nice.
I think we are like now nearing 1 hour mark, which is like the final time frame that we don't like kill our listeners. So Rudy, you're let's say famous already by now. Closing question.
Yeah, we are close to the mark, but I think we are still interesting enough for listeners to not give up on us. So the final question, I think we have really talked a lot about it today, and you, Gunnar, especially have talked about it already. And you know what is the Tourism from Zero's mission, to gain insight and concrete ideas on how to restart tourism from zero. And if you have a concrete idea about restarting tourism, I would love to hear it.
I don't know if I have a concrete idea of restarting tourism in general, but I have one very positive example of how to cope with the crisis, and I think that actually we could learn from. And that's a company called Friðheimar in Icelandic. And that's actually a company that actually grows tomatoes the whole year round in Iceland, but they also have a tourist experience on offer. And so inviting people to see their production, and they present their greenhouses and tell them about how they do this with geothermal heating and artificial lightning and so on, because of the long winters here. And so it's kind of a educational tourism. It's also a culinary tourism. And what happened, what they did when the crisis hit and no tourists came around, they actually decided to invest more in their greenhouses and actually hired the people that used to work in tourism to work on the extension of their business in food production, still with the aim of definitely open up again. And I think it's a really nice example of how tourism can actually, well, how tourism is not only about tourism per se, but it can be combined with so many things. And maybe in that sense, it can be more robust than if it's only thought of as a single unique experience, but it's maybe various things, multiple things. So I think, that's my response to this.
Great, just really the multi-layer of tourism is, you have again emphasized it like when you were saying, when you were traveling, you're doing multiple things. It's also the same for providers, of course, for tourism providers.
Yes.
They can be active in more things, more layers.
Yeah,
great. Tourism that doesn't need to be the first one. It can be a nice additional, no?
Yeah. One more pillar to build on.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Tourism from Zero podcast. Please go and follow our social media pages, Tourism from Zero and Locals from Zero, for more interesting content about tourism. If you're passionate about building a better tourism, you're welcome to join our cause.